Our discussions of women and their rights in Arab countries, or lack, often begin and end with the veil. Women are just not visible in Arab countries like they are in the United States and other Western countries. Our guest this hour got to meet many women away from the places where they are expected to wear the veil. Catherine Zopf wrote a book about what she learned from those women called Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. Catherine Zopf is a senior fellow in the Breadwinning and Caregiving Program at the New America Foundation. Her work covering women in Arab countries has appeared in the New York Times, the New Yorker, and the Chronicle of Higher Education, among other publications. She lived in Syria and Lebanon as a stringer for the Times from 2004 to 2007. Catherine, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do I have your last name pronounced correctly?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Yeah. The first vignette in the book really grabs us. You take us to an engagement party for a 17-year-old Saudi girl. How are marriages arranged to this day in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I don't want to speak about all marriages because it's a country of 27 million and there's a pretty diverse range of ways things are practiced there, but I think it's fair to say that most Saudi women's marriages are still arranged, and if only because, well, not only because, but in part because it's essentially illegal for them to meet men outside their own families, and the way that gender segregation is organized in the kingdom is so extreme that you spend your life as a young woman going from your girls' school to your women's college, and you may hang out on the women only floors of malls. You literally don't have opportunities to encounter young men, and so that leads to some surprising things I found. I mean, I guess I was surprised initially to hear how much romance that the young women I interviewed found in marriages that were arranged and very formal and in which their families were heavily involved. And I found that incredibly interesting.
So how are the marriages arranged? I mean, who decides which people should be together?
There are of course many exceptions and slight regional differences. But if I can generalize based on interviews with many women from different parts of the country, I think it's typically you would have the groom's family, the potential groom's family, will be checking out girls for a period of time, and the women in his family, that is, will be checking out girls for a period of time at women's parties and at the women's sections of weddings, and they'll be looking at the eligible young women, and they'll chat with him about his tastes and what he likes and what he doesn't like, and maybe does he want a well-educated girl? Does he want a girl that shares his interest in traveling, for example? And then they'll start to describe candidates to him, and of course he can't see these women or even see pictures of them. And there's a saying that I heard many times in Saudi Arabia that I was told that was a piece of advice given to men, which was that if you want to get an idea of what your wife will look like, take a good look at her brother. because you won't be shown a photo of her. Sure. until you've proposed, and it's very formal. So eventually some choice will be made, and the groom and his family will come to the home, and if the bride's father is in agreement, then there comes a moment that's called the shofa, which in Arabic it literally means the viewing, and it's a few minutes that a young couple who are going to be engaged to be married have the right to spend in each other's presence with, with the presence of the elders from their families, but the bride is uncovered, so the groom does actually have a chance to see her face and
but this is after engagement, right?
This is usually at the time of engagement, okay. But it's essentially I'm told that for young women, men are given a few options at least. They have different options described to them, but for young women, your option is saying yes or no to this man who has come to your house with his whole family and like sacks of presents that they've bought for your family in order to propose marriage, and to offer your family a dowry, and though women technically have the right to say yes, many of them told me that to all intents and purposes, it's impossible to say yes. You're just so embarrassed, and you're so, it's all so intense. You've never seen spoken to a man outside your family in your whole life, and then suddenly you're the object of all this exciting attention. And so, this is a fairly typical, example of how things happen. It's sort of an example that I heard many times.
Sure. In Saudi Arabia, we should point out, there are four other countries. that you visited.
Yeah,
all right, we'll come back and talk more about Excellent Daughters with the author Catherine Zopf when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Catherine Zopf, who worked as a stringer for the New York Times. Her work has appeared in the Times, the New Yorker, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and other publications. She spent some time living in the Arab world, actually living in the Middle East for about 4 years. In Syria and Lebanon, and spent time in Saudi Arabia and two other countries as well, and compiled the book called Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about women's rights there and by comparison here if you choose as well. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Catherine, just some background on what propelled you into this work, and September 11th apparently had a lot to do with this.
Well, yes, that's true. It was, in fact, I was a pretty new college graduate, and September 11th was actually my second day of work at the New York Times, where I had been hired as an assistant for one of the columnists for then columnist Bill Keller, and I think for many Americans my age and maybe all of us, it really shook up my view of my understanding of the world having an order that I understood. I suddenly felt like nothing I thought I knew about the world was true anymore, and I started reading a lot about the Arab world and about Islam and wanting to go there.
You mentioned in the book that you were brought up as a Jehovah's Witness. How did that affect your sense of what Arab women experience?
I think that many of their experiences did not seem as strange as they did to some of my colleagues, other American journalists who worked in the Middle East. I think they did not. I had known many people in the United States who had who oriented their entire lives around their faith and who felt that was the single most important thing about them and so when I was met large numbers of very conservative young women who felt the same way, I don't think it struck me as perhaps as strange, or maybe it didn't strike me as a barrier to conversation with them. I think that sometimes people are a bit I think we grown up in a society where church and state are separated, you know, famously, and so there's a sort of distance that we give to belief and or that we feel that we can't really talk about it or question it. And I think maybe I didn't have my conditioning in that way was softened by the fact that I felt these were things I knew something about, and I didn't feel as uncomfortable asking, you know, hard questions about what people believed, I guess.
Sure, a basis for comparison with your own stuff, yeah. There are five countries that you detail in the book that you spent time in: Syria, Lebanon, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. And for people who might think of the Middle East and Arab countries as monolithic, I mean, it sounds like there were some fairly significant differences between these countries.
Incredibly significant differences, yes. I tried very hard to show a bit of that in the book, because I think it's often missed. It's easy to look from a distance and to look at the societies as being sort of monolithically oppressive to women or wanting one thing or the other. And in fact, there is in the United States, there's enormous diversity of opinion, you know, within these countries and then among the countries.
Catherine Zoff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. In each place, were you able to latch on to guides, people who could kind of give you an idea of what was normal and what was not for each country?
That's a great question, actually, because these are countries where, none of the countries I reported in has a free media, as anything that resembles a free media, and there are no surveys or readily available statistics on these things, and so getting a sense of something like child marriage, for example, how do you know how widespread that is? Do you, and I came to really believe in the power of anecdote, I guess, and. You know, it's not exact, but I would ask, around, say, just to continue with the example of child marriage, I would ask every woman that I was meeting that week and the next week about, did she know someone when she was a girl, or did she know someone in her, was it in her school, in her class, or was it further, further out in her circle of acquaintance? And so I would hear again and again from women, oh yeah, there were a couple in my class, or from a slightly younger woman, oh yeah, there was a friend of my sister's who got married when she was 10, or, then you would, it's inexact, and obviously, you couldn't. It would be impossible to fully fact check. But if you do enough of it, you do get a pretty good general feel. I could argue for how common something is, and how widespread something is, and whether it's something that's starting to die out, that younger women are seeing less of.
Okay, you said the power of anecdote. That's a good phrase. In Damascus in 2004, speaking of which, there was an incident that stuck with you. There was a knock on the door of your apartment, and a man was there. What was he asking for?
I described this incident in the book, this man asking for a cup of tea. And it was this very ordinary thing for Syrians. I think it was just something that... He was a workman who was working on remodeling the apartment upstairs, and it was just I was just the nearest apartment, and he expected naturally to be able to knock on the door and to have a woman in the household provide him with tea. And this struck me on many levels as interesting. Just the idea of community, I thought, was really kind of lovely and heartwarming, just that people could so easily count on each other for these things, but then again the fact that you know, that a woman would be expected to provide that and to immediately take time away from whatever else she was doing to provide it for, you know, for the man remodeling the apartment, I also thought was telling and a little unsettling. And then there was the fact that he wouldn't look at me. And
that
he,
was what I was struck by. Yeah, he really kind of turned himself away from you.
Yeah, no, and this is, you know, this is something actually that I found really unnerving at first. Many men, especially devout men, wouldn't look at me directly. And it's the Quran will asks believers to lower their gaze. You know, men are not supposed to look at women, and vice versa. And this is something that is meant as honor and politeness, and that, but that feels very different to someone brought up in a society where, you know, when you look somebody in the eye, when you respect them, and it's just a basic sign that, you know, I'm listening to you, I respect you. And, you know, in that chapter, thank you for mentioning that. I think there's a time when you're a newcomer in a place, either a newcomer in a foreign country, or even, you know, if you're moving between cities in the U.S., there are things that you probably notice in your first 2 weeks that you forget to notice very quickly, like all the things that are different, or they do this thing a little differently, or people use this expression that I'd never heard before. And I tried very hard in that first chapter to sort of see what I could remember of those early moments, and see if I could communicate them to some of the things I'd puzzled over or things that had upset me to readers, so that they could maybe get a feel for what it was like, to move to this place, and some of the, you know, the questions that it raised in my mind.
It certainly came through in that incident, and in some, you know, in one sense, it's charming. It's everybody takes care of everybody, so it's not unusual to ask for a cup of tea. But then there's the other part of it, which is the no eye contact and the separation of genders, things that puts a different spin
on
it.
And then you could go a little further and say, you know, and you know, many Syrians would also say this, that your neighbors would also report on you, they keep a very close eye on you, they know what you're up to, and that they would, the secret police forces that are drifting around and asking uncomfortable questions, this sort of this attention to what your neighbors are doing and community spirit, I think, can also be something that people really, really struggle with. And can be dangerous, actually.
Catherine Zoff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. She spent time in 5 different countries in the Arab world to experience what was going on with women, and shares the stories with us. Join us on the Exchange with your questions and comments at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. You described some debate, which is really interesting to me, about whether the current customs are all about Islam, and that's not necessarily apparently.
Well, it isn't necessarily so. I think a bit of care is required. You know, stricter interpretations. And I want to be careful here. Of Islam, essentially forbid believers to do any interpretation. You know, you believe that Islam is one thing, and that it's unchangeable, and that there are judges who may interpret certain of the laws, but you don't question things. And of course, you know, when you look at it from afar, you see actually across the region there, Islam is interpreted in many, many different ways. But in each context, there's usually a lot of anxiety attached to seeming to criticize Islam. And so yes, it's true that many of the practices that women struggle with are about the culture, but they're also about the way Islam is interpreted in a particular context.
But some of the practices may actually predate Islam. Is that what part of what you're saying?
Well, yes. And I did try to describe that, but they've also been appropriated in some cases. So I did want to be careful and to sort of try to explain the culture and how some of these practices that are now conflated with Islam could come from the culture, but also to sort of urge readers to look carefully at the form of Islam that it's practiced in each place, and because I think we can ask some questions about forms of Islam that give women more opportunities or more respect than others. I mean, I guess at the extreme you have you have Saudi Arabia where a woman's word in court is officially worth half that of a man, and it's often discounted still further. There are some judges who won't hear a woman's testimony at all. And that is Saudis will tell you, well, that's Islam, and that's unchangeable. But of course, Saudi Arabia is really alone in interpreting that thing about the women's testimony so strictly. And so obviously, other Islamic countries do interpret things differently.
We're talking to Catherine Zoff on the Jefferson Exchange about her book, Excellent Daughters, The Secret Lives of Young Women Who Are Transforming the Arab World. Just to get into some really basic things about whether it's Islam or tradition doesn't really matter at this point. But the fact is that in the countries you visited, the women are generally covered in all of them, with the possible exception of Lebanon. We'll get into them in a second. But for the people who might not have heard before what the reasons are, what are the reasons and how much do women seem to support those reasons for being veiled?
Well, it's very, very complicated, but across, most of the region, it's a very devout region, and there is a verse late in the Quran that describes that asks believers to speak to women. In this case, referring to the wives of Muhammad from behind a curtain, and this is pretty widely interpreted to mean that all women and not just Muhammad's wives should be secluded, that they should be behind a literal or metaphorical curtain, depending on how you see it, and this is interpreted in very different ways according to the different schools of Islamic jurisprudence, but that's where the basic guideline to veil comes from. Mm-hmm.
Did you find that women generally, women who are wearing the veil, do they generally find reasons within themselves to support the practice?
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. And I described this a bit in the book. I mean, I found it absolutely fascinating how even within one community, that women often had very different ideas about the right way to veil and the wrong way to veil, and she's showing an extra centimeter too much of skin right about in that slit around her eyes, and what does that say about her? And I thought this is fascinating, and also in Saudi Arabia, I also had to by law, all women, including Western visitors, have to wear this black floor-length abaya and headscarf. And I was surprised at how quickly I also developed, sort of feelings about the abaya and sort of almost felt a little bit naked taking it off when I left the kingdom, if that doesn't sound insane.
No, not insane, but that must have been an interesting transition to come back into a Western world.
Well, I just think also, imagine you, well, for the women in your audience, I mean, imagine you had one garment that you could put on and you were always perfectly appropriately dressed, like day to evening. You never had to worry about, you know, whether your trousers were too tight or if your skirt matched your top or if your top was coming untucked, like you're just always fine and comfortable and ready to go. And sort of that was kind of freeing in a funny way. Although, you know, I'm obviously speaking from a position of privilege here since I could, you know, leave and didn't have to wear it. And so I want to be careful here. But yeah, no, it did provoke very passionate reactions, I think.
No doubt. Much more to talk about with Catherine Zoff, who traveled in the Arab world, lived there for a while, and wrote a book called Excellent Daughters about women attempting to change the rights that they have or don't over there. 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Catherine Zoff and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John S. Allen, neuroanthropologist working out of the University of Southern California and the University of Indiana. He's written a book that really makes us think about the places we hang our hats, our cribs, so to speak. Home, How Habitat Made Us Human is the book by John Allen. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the significance of how we as a species developed in conjunction with these structures that we've built over the years. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Neanderthals burying people in addition to cannibalizing some of them, it sounds like. What's the significance?
So Neanderthals bury their dead, and some anthropologists have said, oh, it's just corpse disposal, that there's no reason to read any more into it. But burying a big, full male Neanderthal is no small task. It actually takes a lot of planning. It would probably take help. I mean, these are heavy, large individuals, and so it's not something I think you can just sort of write off. But I, as I say in the book, I see corpse burying somebody is about retaining the corpse as well, and many times they're in these sort of cave living sites, which to me shows that there was some care taken to keep them there, probably to keep them where they lived in their life, and so that's a hint to me that there is some sort of place recognition, a relationship of the people who live there and the place that that person may have lived. Now, I'd say that recognition doesn't mean there has to be a symbolic component. Doesn't mean they represented anything other than that. And so to me, it is a hint there that these caves where there are buried dead are actually something home-like to a Neanderthal, which makes sense. Neanderthals are large-brained, clearly we're capable of sophisticated behavior, not quite the technological level as us, although it seems like from the archaeological record, when they ran into modern human technologies, at least some of them were able to take them on. So it's maybe not surprising that there was a feeling for home there, even if we can't find a Neanderthal hut or house anywhere.
Interesting. So having the dead nearby would have made it more of a home, in essence.
That's what I mean, that's my interpretation. I mean, I think it's a more simple interpretation than to think that, as some have argued, that there's some large symbolic component.
How critical, John, do you think fire, the use of fire as in a hearth, appeared to be in the development of the home concept?
Well, it's always been, you know, in the archaeological record, if you do have actual structures to look at, if you look for one with a fire, that tends to be the one that's identified as a living space, as a home. But as we go back perhaps millions of years, a million or 2 million years, or if we go back to the earlier branches of our tree, they're living on branches still. Even if they're bipedal, walking on two legs, it seems they probably were using trees still. And the one thing you can't do in a tree is set a fire and make it and cook it.
Right.
So you got to come to the ground for that and spend time on the ground. And so fire, I think, is this sort of step that pushes us out of the trees for once and for all. And also, it becomes that it's also linked into this whole idea of, you know, more energy to support growing brains, to be able to cook tougher meats, large hunks, or to be able to cook big tubers that grow underground that would be otherwise very difficult for us to eat or digest. And so, yeah, I think home is I mean, and fire is probably an integral part of developing home life.
Well, and then there's an interesting aside here that you attribute to the folks at CELF, C-E-L-F, at UCLA, mm-hmm. About the modern hearth, what they figured out that is.
The modern hearth is a TV. Because it's the orient, and when they've looked at households, of course, this will now change as people get video screens that are personalized.
Mm-hmm.
But at least in this era that we're maybe coming to an end, starting in the 1950s, the TV was the organizing thing. As that is, you know, you could often, once you see a room with a TV, you already have an impression of activity patterns in that room because people will be oriented toward the TV.
As opposed to the fireplace in
exactly.
decades past, yeah. Here's a call from Madeline in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Allen.
Hi. What occurs to me is that our attachment to our cell phones, tablets, and laptops possibly is how we keep our homes portable, and maybe because in some ways we feel so insecure in this mm-hmm. society, having these objects is like having our home be more portable and that we bring with us. We bring it with us everywhere.
Yeah.
Interesting concept, especially when so much can be accessed through the phone. Thanks for the thought, Madeline. Appreciate that. John, what do you make of that?
Well, I think I actually was talking to some, had a previous interview where they asked me about traveling and home and how you feel at home. And I have to say that when you travel and I get, you know, if there's a decent Wi-Fi in whatever cheap hotel I'm staying at, and I look at my phone and I look at these websites that I look at when I'm at home, all of a sudden I feel more at home. Right, that instead of, and some people do that, you know, I had a friend who's a big hiker, and he was saying how, you know, he goes on a hike, he's away from the house, and he has his kit, and when he sits down with his kit, and he takes out his coffee pot and his little lantern and a few items, all of a sudden this place in the middle of nowhere that he's never been before is more like home. And so I think you can do that electronically as well and maintain those connections, which are triggering something very deep inside you, right? It's not necessarily a conscious thing, but all of a sudden, looking at the newspaper or listening to the radio station on the podcast from back home, and I feel more comfortable.
Well, which raises a question that Grumpy John in Grants Pass dropped off. He asks about nomads, such as the Bedouins mm-hmm. or people of the Great Plains, in the sense that you're talking about a concept of home that up till now has seemed fixed, and yet tribes were not fixed, but they still have homes.
That's right. Well, I think to some extent you would probably have them have this sort of expansive view of home as the whole landscape that they go over. But also a lot of those nomadic groups, they travel with a kit. Right, of some mm-hmm. stuff, items, portable housing. You know, it isn't just we're going to walk and we're not going to reestablish life again from and rebuild and remake things from the stuff we find in the next spot, but they already have this. And I suspect that's their home, right, is a more portable version.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you know, home isn't that you live in an apartment or a mansion or a cell or a yurt or a tent or whatever. You can make those things feel like home because it's defined from within rather than by your surroundings.
We have a question here that goes a little more to the anthropology side, and it's about from James in Arcata. He writes, I spent some time in West Africa and noted the differences in the perceptions of personal space among the folks for whom group living with multiple children from multiple moms is the norm. Question one, are we in the developed world particularly stressed by long hours alone, one-on-one with one infant? Question two is whether you have any insights into the migrant movements currently in the news and how we can address their home needs.
Well, the first is that it's quite possible. I mean, anomie is an isolation and loneliness are people would say are hallmarks of a big complex society. Is that you could be lonelier in a group of a million than you can be with 100, right? Because mm-hmm. you can be isolated, not have a group. So I think there is probably something to that as we pare down our social groups that we interact with. It's probably the house structure itself is not sufficient. It is partly the relationships you have within them.
Mm-hmm.
As for the migrant issues, and I think that also it relates also to people who are homeless for economic reasons or for mental illness or for whatever reason, is I hope it makes everyone reflect on what a devastating thing it is to not have a home. That is, when you take your own home for granted, that probably limits your ability to have sympathy for someone who also doesn't have a home. But if you actually reflect on how important home is, not just to your comfort, but to your psychological well-being, to establishing your place within the larger social group, I think you have to recognize that what is going through people, refugees or others who are without home, what a devastating blow that can be.
It's a really profound effect, as you document in a whole chapter about homelessness. And in fact, there's a phrase in it that really caught my eye: physically housed, but cognitively homeless. What does that mean?
Well, I think that can be used in any of the people who are homeless, either maybe because of, as a secondary result of mental illness or addiction. I think also may apply to, say, foster children who grow up in a sort of revolving house situation, that they never have that sort of learning period, that they never learn in a critical time, just like language you have to pick up in a critical period, how to be at home, how to feel at home. And so when you get out of that system and you're on your own, your life is unsettled. And people who age out of foster care systems have very high rates of incarceration and other psychological problems. I'm not saying this is the only cause, but I think that would contribute to it.
Let's take another call. Here's Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about home with John S. Allen.
I came into this late, so I don't know if anybody has mentioned yet that homes are actually a byproduct. They're from when man switched over from being a hunter-gatherer into an agrarian lifestyle, and you had to plant yourself in one place for months at a time waiting for your crops to come in. So you start building more sturdy abodes instead of just lean-tos and tents. And you start settling down in one place because, well, this is fertile. We can do this year after year. They're just a byproduct of, you know, man settling down as opposed to wandering around and gathering food as he can.
Okay, good point. Thanks for that, Steve. John?
Yeah,
thoughts?
Well, I would actually say it's not home. That's when houses and other structural dwellings became vehicles for all sorts of other things, right? For when we settled down and started building homes, all sorts of, and we became agricultural, all sorts of other, you know, status changes become more profound. And a lot of those are advertised in the structure you live in. But I would arguing that feeling of home from the inside out, before agriculture, before we had obvious houses, is there in terms of how we define a space that's separate from, that's our own and ostensibly under control, and maybe it really isn't under control, but we feel that way.
But my place
from the wild world.
Mm-hmm. You go through a chapter here on housing booms and busts and things like that, and it raises the question about home ownership itself, which we talk about a bit, as distinct from just having a home. I mean, how modern a phenomenon is this drive to own your own home?
Well, I think it is. It's pretty modern. I mean, in terms of the U.S., it became explicitly in the 1920s sort of a campaign to encourage home ownership. It had been going on before that, but basically home ownership is seen as to make you an active part of the democracy, as a property-owning democracy. Home ownership was encouraged that way, and it's encouraged as a vehicle for savings, and of course the government policy, the government, although it isn't listed as a cost necessarily, but the tax write-off you get on mortgages is a tremendous government support for home ownership itself. And so what we have then is your home, your house, becomes part of the economic system, and in places where there are housing, when prices are going up, when houses seem to be getting more and more expensive, almost as you look every week at the prices, then, and houses become investments, I think there is a bit of a conflation there between your feelings for home, which is for security and stability, and how your house is acting out in the economic world. And one line I sort of go into there is, to what extent can this become a confidence amplifier? as economists would say. That is, you may not be able to perceive the risk you're taking in buying a house because it's your home, and your home is there to protect you. And therefore, we often see these stories when people lose their houses due to foreclosure or something. It always seems quite a devastating blow. It isn't just the same thing as going bankrupt. It's like being it's like being betrayed by the thing you live in.
Well, in a sense, it's ultimately then an emotional relationship. I mean, particularly when you think about the ways that we pick houses, you know, it's like, well, okay, the bathroom's a little small and the closets are crap, but boy, it just feels like home.
Exactly. Oh, it's emotional. That's the key thing to take away. I think these emotions, these feelings of home, they've served us, but, you know, they can also get us, blind us to certain other things in the world around us.
Well, it's a fascinating look at the relationship that we have with our living spaces, and it just goes beyond the four walls and a couch, maybe, and a TV. The book is called Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. It's the work of John S. Allen, neuroanthropologist and research scientist in the University of Southern California and the University of Indiana. John, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.